This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's show, we continue exploring the ballot proposals you'll face next Tuesday. Today, a look at Proposal 6, the bridge proposal.
I think you could probably fairly see this as a last-ditch attempt to make sure that that new crossing doesn't happen.
We will check on the prospects for the highly anticipated Winter Classic between the Red Wings and Maple Leafs at Michigan Stadium. And a conversation with Tom Hayden, here to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the Port Huron Statement and the birth of the SDS.
No one quite has put their finger on why this was inspired here in the Midwest and not in the ghettos of New York or the Bay Area.
Those stories and much more coming up today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. Happy Thursday. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's show, with just 5 days to go before Election Day, we'll take a look at Proposal 6, the so-called bridge proposal. Plus, Tom Hayden stops by. We'll talk about the 50th anniversary of the Port Huron Statement, the statement that launched the SDS and student activism on campuses across the country. But first, no matter who wins or loses in next Tuesday's election, there's no arguing the fact that one group of folks can count themselves as winners, hands down. The people who sell advertising in Michigan, be it billboards, print ads, and the never-ending flood of TV and radio commercials, all of that advertising has made this one of the most expensive elections in the history of Michigan. Joining us to discuss just how much money's been spent and who is spending it, we welcome Rich Robinson of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network and Michigan Radio's Lester Graham of Michigan Watch. So, Rich, Lester, I want to focus today on the Supreme Court races and the ballot proposals. First off, which proposal has turned out to be the priciest?
It's Proposal 2 by a pretty wide margin. You might say that a certain amount of that applies to 3 and 4 because some of it's been spent by the Just Say No movement. But the proponents have spent over $22 million. One of the opponent campaigns has spent over $19 million, and the generic Just Say No is over $7 million.
And Lester, there's certainly no surprise the Maroon family has been dipping into its essentially bottomless piggy bank to get us to vote yes on Proposals 5 and 6. How much sway has this made in all of this?
Well, in Proposal 6, it seems to be having quite a bit of influence on people. And if you don't just count this election cycle, but you count the total amount that they've spent on Proposal 6, and this, again, is from Michigan Campaign Finance Network, it's getting close to $40 million over the last 3 or 4 years. Now, that's not just this election cycle or the money that's spent on Proposal 6, but just the idea of stopping this new international trade crossing that the governor is in favor of and Canada wants to pay for. So that's a lot of money, but when you think about the amount of money that they make from the Ambassador Bridge, it's just an investment.
Does this trend alarm you?
It doesn't seem much like democracy to me. It seems like we're game pieces in a giant game of risk that's being run by cranky billionaires. Whether you're talking about the federal campaigns with Sheldon Adelson and the Koch brothers or domestically with Maddie Maroon, all the campaign speech is being dominated by just a few players.
With deep pockets.
Right. And there's a lot of dark money this year. We're seeing it not just in the ballot proposals or in the congressional races, but we're also seeing it in the Supreme Court races, which is particularly disturbing. And Rich has done a good job of looking into that. I saw, Rich, that you'd reported that 75% of the money in the Michigan Supreme Court races is off the books.
Well, and that was before the announcement the Judicial Crisis Network was going to spend $1 million attacking Bridget McCormick. So you can add $1 million to the $10 million of dark money. And then there's the whole matter that we can't even put a number on the direct mail that's been spent by the political parties.
Yeah, that's one of the things, I've been working with Rich this year, finding out more about what's available And Rich actually travels from TV station to TV station to look at their books to see what's being spent. But there's a lot of stuff you can't find out because the U.S. Postal Service doesn't tell you how much people spend in mailers. The robocalls, you know, could be done anywhere, and it's hard to say where to go to get that numbers. And even if you did know where to go, they wouldn't give them to you. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of money that's being spent that we'll never really know about, especially in these days of dark money where these independent expenditures from out of state are going in, but they don't have to say who wrote the checks and who's backing what proposals. And again, that's especially worrisome when you're talking about the Michigan Supreme Court candidates.
And we have talked to those candidates, and each of them professes to be very uncomfortable with the process of having to run and taking donations and the appearance to voters. And these are certainly not transparent.
Well, they certainly should be uncomfortable. And, you know, there's another piece of what's going on this year, and that's an Oakland County Circuit Court race where there's $2 million of dark money, part of it being spent through this Judicial Crisis Network, the other part through Americans for Job Security. But $2 million in a trial court race, I think, is unheard of nationally.
Yeah, it really makes you worry about judicial impartiality.
Well, and that seems to be the case of a vengeful billionaire just trying to knock somebody out who didn't rule a case his way.
So that is setting precedent, and you know it's being, as you say, it's almost like we're in a petri dish and we're being used as study subjects. So what does that say for elections and the whole process of running for office for the future? What needs to change?
Well, I'd say fundamentally, the first thing that needs to change is we have to have authentic transparency in these political campaigns. It should be intolerable that the parties are not reporting who's given them most of the money they're spending.
Yeah, I think the one thing that's really a concern, if we've decided as a society that money equals free speech, okay, fine, that's the decision that's been made. But if you're going to, you know, if you're going to speak, you have to expose yourself. You have to disclose that you're speaking. Under these rules, they don't have to disclose who's speaking. It's kind of cowardice in a way because I'm going to do this, but I don't want anyone to know I'm doing it. I think if you're going to stand up for something, you ought to reveal yourself.
What should they?
Absolutely. Free speech, but accountable speech.
So what should the voters of Michigan who are listening to this discussion right now take away from this? What should they be aware of, be pushing for going forward?
Well, again, I'd go back to the transparency idea, because if this is the foundation of our politics, money laundering on an industrial scale, that which sits on top of it is certainly questionable as far as integrity.
I'm going to talk about treating the symptoms. I think what you do is you don't believe any political ad you hear or see. You just don't believe it. Go do your own homework. There is information available. I just think that if they find out these ads don't have effect on the voters, maybe we won't see money spent this way. Unfortunately, right now we know the ads do have an effect on voting.
It'll be interesting to see if all of that money spent on the proposals, what actually happens on Tuesday. And if it does blow up, who knows? Who knows how it's going to turn out? But if it doesn't buy the vote they want, it'll be interesting to see what happens the next time around.
Well, it would be nice if the interest groups would come together and get some sense of the common good, because I think what we're going to find here is the battlefield is littered with bodies and nobody won.
Mm. And I guess at that, we'll leave it at that, and we'll maybe do some post-election Wednesday morning quarterbacking after it's all said and done. Thank you for talking with us, Rich Robinson of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network, and of course, Michigan Radio's Michigan Watch reporter, Lester Graham. Good to have you with us.
Good to be with you.
Moving now from politics to sports. This week is shaping up to serve a double dose of disappointment for sports fans here in Michigan. First, we saw the Tigers swept right out of the World Series by San Francisco. And now it looks like we're going to lose an event that had a lot of hockey fans very excited. Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon joins us now. John, does it seem that the death knell may toll for the Winter Classic?
I will bet 100% on that, baby. But, of course, I picked the Tigers, so...
Okay, well, what do you know,
right?
Okay, so we know there's this lockout going on that has wrecked the first couple months of the season. Is there any hope that the Winter Classic could be rescheduled if the lockout is settled?
NHL has already said officially they will not reschedule it, even if they do settle it. So the odds are looking very bleak right now for the first Winter Classic at a college stadium, which in this case, of course, is Michigan's, and also the first one with a Canadian team, which in this case would have been the Toronto Maple Leafs with the Detroit Red Wings. So
it would have been great.
I would say the party is over.
And obviously it all comes down to money, right?
It comes down to money for sure, but in the case of the NHL, of course, with the lockout, there is no hockey, so no hockey, no game. So the problem here, of course, is the NHLPA and the NHL owners are miles apart, which only proves my point once again that hockey is the best game and the dumbest league. It cannot afford to do this. They really can't. When baseball goes on strike, people still love baseball. They come back. They're okay. Football, same thing. Hockey does not have that luxury, and this will once again alienate fans. Right when the game started to get popular again, the NBC network had the best ratings they've ever had with hockey the last winter. And, of course, the NHL turns right around and shoots themselves in the foot.
John, why is it that this date, that tomorrow, is such an important date for making a decision on the Winter Classic?
Oh, that's where you're dead right, of course. That is all about the Benjamins, as we say. If they don't cancel by, I think it's this weekend, they would have to pay Michigan $250,000 on Friday, another $1 million on December 7th, and on December 28th, an additional $650,000. So add all that up, it's almost $2 million. So they will at least cut their losses, pay Michigan $100,000. They've already paid them that anyway. That's the deposit. And that will be all Michigan gets. The good news for Michigan is that you get paid $100,000 for essentially doing nothing. So
yeah.
In that sense, nothing lost. And it's not like anyone else is going to play there that day. So for Michigan, it's not too big a loss. They lose an opportunity is what they lose. They lose a chance to make more money. But it's not money out of their pocket.
Well, speaking as a fan, I guess, would we see a push to reschedule this matchup in the Winter Classic for 2014?
You'll see. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And my strong hunch would be that everything had gone well to that point with Michigan doing this and bringing in the Toronto Maple Leafs. The demand was set to be very, very high because you not only have University of Michigan people who want to see their stadium, you want to have Detroit Red Wing fans coming in for the game. You have Maple Leaf fans coming in 4 hours, which for them is
nothing.
Trust me.
Right.
Exactly. for a game like this. So the demand already seemed to be extremely high, the excitement very high. So I'd be very surprised if they did not reschedule the game for January 1st, 2014, the next season.
John Eubakin, Michigan Radio sports commentator. Good to have you with us. Thanks for talking with us today.
Likewise. Thank you.
Still to come, we continue our conversations with the candidates who want your vote for state Supreme Court. On today's show, Judge Colleen O'Brien. That's coming up in 10 minutes here on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As we head into these final days before Election Day, we continue taking a closer look at the six proposals on Michigan's ballot. Today, Proposal 6, the bridge proposal, as most of us would call it. As we mentioned earlier in this show, it's been the focus of a mind-blowing amount of money spent by the Maroon family. Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick's been covering the bridge story, and she joins us now to take a look at Prop 6. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start by making things crystal clear. What does Proposal 6 say, and what does a yes vote mean, and what does a no vote mean?
What Proposal 6 proposes to do is it would, in the words of the ballot language, require the approval of a majority of voters at a statewide election when any new international bridges or tunnels for motor vehicles are to be located in the state of Michigan. And there's some other language in there. But basically what it means is that there would have to be an election, a referendum, anytime the state wanted to build a new international border crossing. And there's been some dispute legally about whether this would apply only to international crossings. That is outlined pretty clearly in the language of the proposal. But Governor Snyder and some people who are against Proposal 6 say that it would actually apply to any infrastructure projects within the state. But regardless, A yes vote on Proposal 6 means that for any new international crossings the state wants to build, there needs to be a statewide referendum on it. A no vote means no, that the state can go ahead and build an international crossing if it wants to.
Circle back and kind of set the stage for us, Sarah. This was all born out of the plans announced by Governor Snyder and the government of Canada to build a competing bridge between Michigan and Ontario. And from that, we were pretty much off to the races, weren't we?
Yes, this has all been in the works for years, but things really got going under Governor Snyder. He really came in very determined that this bridge was going to get built. He has laid out repeatedly and clearly one of the statistics he likes to use the most is that one-third of all North American trade occurs between the corridor connecting Montreal and Chicago. And to get from Montreal to Chicago, where do you need to go?
Mm.
Well, probably through Detroit. And right now we only have one commercial border crossing in Detroit, and that's the Ambassador Bridge. So he's laid out repeatedly this economic case that we need an additional bridge to facilitate this traffic and that that will be an economic boost for the region. And the government of Canada believes that as well and is wholeheartedly behind this new bridge, the new international trade crossing, I guess they're calling it now.
Right.
But as things have really gained momentum under Governor Snyder, and finally this summer he signed an agreement with the Canadian government officially to go ahead and build this new bridge, the owners of the Ambassador Bridge, who do not want the new bridge, don't want that competition, as in a commercial border crossing in Detroit, have basically taken to the ballot. And I think you could probably fairly see this as a last-ditch attempt to make sure that that new crossing doesn't happen.
And certainly the Maroon family, owners of the Ambassador Bridge, have deep pockets. When we've all heard these kind of eye-popping figures of some $30 million spent in commercials and in efforts to get a yes vote on Proposal 6. And there seems to be a fair amount of criticism from the anti-Prop 6 forces portraying the content of these Prop 6 commercials bought with all this money as stretching the truth, to put it kindly. Do you think that's a fair assessment, or is there some truth to the commercials?
Anyone who, you know, has followed the story knows who is behind Proposal 6. It's the Maroon family, the Detroit International Bridge Company, and clearly they don't want the competing crossing. Now, you can look at the commercials, which tend to mention things like money for education and firefighters and public services, and suggesting that, you know, we shouldn't be spending those scarce resources on building another international crossing, and that the state of Michigan will be on the hook for the cost of this new
mm-hmm.
international crossing, although the Canadian government and Governor Snyder swear that that won't be the case. That's where the attention in the commercial is really focused. And I think it's fair to say that that's not really what this proposal is about, and that if Proposal 6 is passed, there probably won't magically be more money for schools or firefighters.
I want to get your thoughts, since you have been very much involved in covering this story.
Mm-hmm.
For the people in Southwest Detroit, whose lives would be tremendously impacted either way, whether there is a second bridge or not, what are their thoughts on getting that second bridge and on this proposal?
Well, it's interesting. I was actually down in Delray, which is the community that will be directly impacted, is supposed to host the new international trade crossing.
Right.
I think it's fair to say that the people who are very involved in the community are very much anti-Proposal 6, that is to say that they want the bridge, they want the new international trade crossing. Hmm. People you just sort of run into, I ran into a couple people who didn't know what Proposal 6 was, don't know that it affects them at all, although they understand the issues with the new bridge. But for them, it's just been this long waiting game of many, many years waiting to see if they're going to be bought out of their neighborhood and if that new bridge is ever going to happen. And it started out, I think it's fair to say, with a lot of support in the neighborhood. But the longer this goes on, the more that support dwindles and people really feel like, well, is this ever going to happen? Does it matter? And in the meantime, the community has gone through this sort of vicious cycle of disinvestment as people don't know whether the bridge is going to be built or not, whether their business or their home or their church is going to exist in a few years. And so a neighborhood that was already struggling has just gone into a downward spiral. And in the meantime, this is all dragging out in terms of a big fight between Governor Snyder and the Canadian government and the Maroon family.
And let's just say there is a yes vote and Proposal 6 passes.
Mm-hmm.
What happens?
If there's a yes vote and Proposal 6 happens, it probably goes to court, and we probably see some kind of also political, legislative, or, you know, political workings around the restrictions that this proposal would put on international crossings. Already, Governor Schneider and the Canadian government have said they think that the agreement they have for the new bridge is legally insulated from the ballot or from the language of this ballot proposal, although obviously they don't want to deal with that eventuality. If there's a no vote, the Detroit International Bridge Company has spent millions of dollars in court over the years fighting over issues surrounding the Ambassador Bridge and a new span and the proposed new bridge. And the bridge company president, Dan Stamper, has said they're not giving up that fight. So either way, we're going to end up in court.
I know that the Maroon family and the bridge company has said, we'll build a second bridge.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any possible basis that anyone can see for the two sides, or the three sides, if you will, Government of Canada, Governor Schneider, and the Maroon family being able to agree on how and where to do this? Has that been approached at all, to your knowledge?
Not to my knowledge, and I just don't see it being possible on a practical level, because the fact is that the Canadian government does not want a twin span to the Ambassador Bridge. They don't like the location of the Ambassador Bridge right now. They don't like the fact that it goes through downtown Windsor. And
sure.
They know if they were going to build another span and increase or even keep traffic, you know, they're going to have to, you know, run through historic neighborhoods and the University of Windsor and all these things. I mean, they're just dead set against it. And it's also, you know, there's been already this building up of infrastructure for the new international trade crossing on the Canadian side downriver. And what they really want is a straight shot on these expressways for this commercial truck traffic that's, you know, carrying a third of the trade of North America to cross the border at Detroit. So I guess I just don't see, you know, the Maroon family may want to build their bridge, and they can make that case, and, you know, and I guess on a number of levels, but where are they going to build it to?
Sarah Swick, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Now continuing our conversations with the candidates for Michigan Supreme Court. Today we're joined by Judge Colleen O'Brien, who currently sits on the Oakland County Circuit Court. Judge O'Brien, welcome.
Thank you so much.
What impelled you to decide to make the move and run for the state Supreme Court?
Well, I practiced law for 17 years prior to becoming a judge back in 1998. And I'm running for the Supreme Court basically for the same reason I ran for Circuit Court. And that is because when I practiced law, I had the opportunity to travel around our state and appear in the courtrooms of many different judges. And I would have basically the same set of facts and be arguing a case in the same area of law, but I'd go to three different counties and get three different decisions. And it was very frustrating because that is not the way that our legal system is supposed to work.
Hmm.
We're supposed to have stability and predictability in our laws, and we need judges that follow the law. So that's why I ran back in 98, and now after sitting as a circuit judge for 14 years, you know, it's clear to me how important it is to have a Supreme Court that it follows the rule of law and sets a good example for the rest of the courts in our state.
And as you have decided to make your run for the state Supreme Court, I'm sure you spent a lot of time thinking about what your view is of the role of a justice on the state Supreme Court. Could you share that with us?
Yes. I believe that it's very important for anyone that is seeking the position of Supreme Court justice to strictly adhere to the rule of law. And what I mean by that is I believe that judges must decide cases not based on what they personally think the law should be, but what the law actually is. I believe that judges need to set aside their personal opinion and viewpoint and base their decisions on the law as it's been written by our elected representatives. And that's not always an easy thing to do. You know, there have been many times over the years when I would have preferred to do something differently. And if I was sitting in the legislature, I probably would have written the law differently. But as a rule of law judge, which I believe our justices must be, we can't be driven by the outcome. We have to be driven by the law itself and respect the separation of powers and realize that it's our legislators that are writing the law, not our judges.
Judge O'Brien, what's your opinion of future Supreme Courts overturning past high court decisions?
Well, I think that on a rare occasion that can be done if something was decided clearly erroneously, if something was, clearly wrong. But I think that that's something that we have to be very cautious about, and that it should not be done very often.
In recent years, as you think about Michigan's high court, what do you feel are the one or two most significant state Supreme Court actions, we'll say just in recent years, in the last 5 years or so?
I think probably the recent decision that was made to allow the ballot proposals to go forward,
mm-hmm.
I think was very significant. It was a unanimous decision, very controversial, and, I think it's very significant to show, though, that we have a rule of law court that maybe, felt strongly that they were following the law and giving the right to the people to go forward with these ballot initiatives, whether they personally agreed with it or not. So I think that was very significant. And also, I think, there's been a lot of decisions in the past few years in the area of tort law that were controversial. But I think that the judges, again, are following the law. We've had a Republican legislature primarily for the last decade and a half or last two decades. And so our law tends to be more conservative because those are the laws that our legislatures are passing. There has been changes in the tort law. They're more, the law's more restrictive now. And so that is significant, a significant change. But again, I think that the court was following the rule of law when they did that.
Talking about following the rule of law and being nonpartisan, how difficult is that when we have a system that basically involves party nominations and fundraising?
Well, you're right. There are some flaws in our system. I will say, though, that with the fundraising, it's a necessary evil because we have to be able to communicate with the voters. And there's really no way to do that unless we have funds and fundraising that goes along with it. And I can honestly say that in my time as a judge, I really don't know of any judges that have ever been influenced by taking a campaign contribution. I mean, I really think that, all the judges that I know of are very honorable, and they're not influenced by that. There's been other suggestions that maybe we have, the governor appoint the justices,
mm-hmm.
that maybe we have a panel of people who come together and make recommendations to a governor, and the governor has to pick from that panel. But the problem with those systems is that then the voters are taken out of the equation. And there have been some surveys over the past few years that show that the voters do want to be able to participate in the selection of their justices.
Although we saw that recent cover story in the Free Press, the front page story, saying that most voters really don't know who they're voting for. They don't recognize the names of the candidates, except for, as they said, women with Irish last names. But
yeah. It's a problem. We need to try to maybe come up with a way for better voter communication. I'm not sure exactly how we do that, but I agree with you. There needs to be better education.
Judge O'Brien, getting past the election, looking ahead, let's say, yes, you're elected and you are a member of the Michigan Supreme Court. What do you see as the biggest challenges the high court will face?
Well, I think the biggest challenges are diminishing resources and still delivering justice to the citizens of Michigan. And, that's not going to be an easy thing to do. I think the Supreme Court has, done a wonderful job of streamlining the court system. Thus far, I think that in the future, what we're going to need to do is try to get the courts to cooperate and work together with concurrent jurisdiction. For example, in circuit court here in Oakland County, we're extremely busy, and we've been pretty fortunate lately to have many of our district judges in Oakland County come forward and offer to help with different matters. So I think that all the courts in the state really need to look into entering into concurrent jurisdiction plans between the probate, district, and circuit court. And I think that that way we're going to be able to, battle this the lack of funding and diminishing resources that we're going to have in the future.
And finally, Judge, if you would just talk to the voters who are listening right now and just say to them why you think you deserve to have a seat on the state's highest court.
Okay. Well, the Michigan Supreme Court handles only the most difficult and complex issues in our state. So I believe that it's very important that anyone seeking the position have the adequate experience to serve on the Supreme Court. And as I mentioned earlier, I've had a wonderful experience here handling civil criminal matters, family court matters, appeals from the district court, probate court, and different administrative agencies. It's all the issues that the Supreme Court sees. So I believe I have the adequate experience. And, I hope that the voters will have faith in me and that they'll honor me with being elected in next week, next Tuesday.
That's right. It's hard to believe it's here at last, isn't it?
Coming quickly, yes.
Candidate Colleen O'Brien, currently sitting on the Oakland County Circuit Court and running for Michigan Supreme Court. Judge O'Brien, thank you for talking with us today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Here at Stateside, we really want to connect with you. We want to hear your comments, suggest a story, or suggest someone you think we should profile. You can find us online at michiganradio.org. On Facebook, all you have to do is search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty, and on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Still to come, we're going to speak with a young man from Grand Rapids who is walking across the state of Michigan. Yep, you heard that right. We'll continue our chats with Michigan's local heroes. That's coming up in 15 minutes here on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. To those of us who came of age in the 60s, the SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, was a part of our consciousness. Perhaps you were on a college or university campus and part of the rising student movement, fueled, among many things, by the war in Vietnam, the war on poverty, and the civil rights and women's rights movement. Perhaps you were still in grade school or high school, as I was. But nonetheless, you knew something was happening, and it felt important. It has been 50 years since members of the newly formed Students for a Democratic Society came together in Port Huron for a retreat. 5 days later, they had produced the Port Huron Statement, spelling out their vision of participatory democracy, how and why students would take part in the many left and liberal causes. To mark the 50th anniversary of that historic manifesto of the SDS, the University of Michigan's holding a 3-day conference exploring the Port Huron Statement. Joining us today on Stateside is the writer who drafted and finalized the Port Huron Statement and who has spent his life since then as an activist, a writer, a teacher, a legislator. Welcome to Tom Hayden. Good to have you with us today,
sir. I'm delighted to be here in Ann Arbor. I love Ann Arbor, and I'm proud to have graduated from the university, and I'm proud that they're taking ownership of this unique and historical movement, the SDS, that arose here and went through several phases. And I think it's important that all the phases had something to do with Ann Arbor. Even Bill Ayers of the Weather Underground, who was the last phase of a 8-year period.
8 years, wow.
9 years.
Yeah.
I remember him, Billy Ayers. He was a younger generation SDSer who was very active in an alternative school in Ann Arbor. Mm-hmm. And then in the middle years, Ann Arbor produced Carl Oglesby, who was one of the great orators of the time. He was a playwright. He was a graduate student in defense research, and he helped lead the movement against the Vietnam War. Port Huron was like the cradle, the golden early
birth,
years.
Yes. Yeah,
yeah. But really, when you think about it, Ann Arbor or Michigan maybe had to be the cradle of it all, because no one quite has put their finger on why this was inspired here in the Midwest and not in the ghettos of New York or
yes.
the Bay Area. I'm not sure that I know, but there's something about the place. And so it's, I think, very important that the university addresses the fact that this happened here and not shy away from it.
I want to have you take us back a little bit. Your time growing up in Royal Oak and going to Dondero High and then coming to U of M, all of that happening in the Eisenhower 50s was very much an era not about students as activists. So where and when did that activist spark happen for you?
Well, I would say I was one of those idealists and nonconformists who read James Joyce. And if you look at the Stephen Dedalus character, he says some very dreamy things. I remember the most important thing about Port Huron is that we tried to articulate at Port Huron what James Joyce called the uncreated conscience of our generation.
That phrase struck a chord for you as you read it as a young guy.
Yeah, but I was also influenced by the late sociologist C. Wright Mills, who taught us about the power elite in a sophisticated way. He taught us about the dangers of apathy in a mass society. We were very influenced by the French philosopher Albert Camus, who had written a book, The Plague, about when you're in the midst of such suffering, the only thing to do is to take action. We were influenced by the Beat Generation, by Howl and by On the Road. There was Arnold Kaufman, who gave us the phrase participatory democracy, which came down through time from John Dewey. We can overdo the generation gap thesis. That was certainly true enough. But there was also a generational exchange going on in Ann Arbor between our professors and ourselves. And above all, we were moved by the idea from the Black sit-in movement, the Southern movement, which I was part of, mm-hmm. that there was a purpose to life that was worth dying for. Most of us were wandering the campus, you know, having no particular purpose at all. My purpose was at the Daily to become a journalist, which meant get a byline. Mm-hmm. So if I interviewed Martin Luther King, which I did, it was to get a byline. Mm-hmm. And it took me a while to realize that
it was a little superficial.
Shallow of me to be looking at this man who had a purpose, whereas my miniature purpose was to get a job on a newspaper. It was a time, it didn't last so long, but many thousands of people, maybe millions, felt that they were going to devote the rest of their lives to these causes. Hmm. It's hard to imagine.
Because we don't have that sense today.
We have certainly have it, but on a lesser scale, mm-hmm. yeah.
Well, in fact, one of the lines...
And it's less affordable if you're an Ann Arbor student.
That's true. That's so true. One of the lines in the Port Huron statement that struck a chord for me is you talk about that yours, and here's the quote, may be the last generation in the experiment with living. That fear of doomsday was so much informed our lives in that era. Do you think there's a similar fear with after 9/11
global
for today's...
Warming.
Global warming? Is that the fear today?
Well, a good, you know, scientific approach taken by a professor here today, Henry Pollack in Ann Arbor, if you read the scientific findings carefully and you're a young person, you have to conclude that the world as we know it is going to end in your lifetime. That plus a bad economy puts you very much in the position we were. I actually think global warming is harder to manage than the nuclear arms race, but they're both life-threatening specters. We're talking about all life, the wellsprings of life. And if you combine that with the pressure students are under with loans and indebtedness and the job outlook, these are pretty and inequality. These are similar challenges to what we faced, and the fact that we were able to go on is, I think, the good news, because these can be really numbing. I mean, if you tell a kid in the classroom that the world is going to end, the polar bears are going to be the first sign of it, with the Jersey Shore is another sign of it, it's coming. It can be so paralyzing that you fall into an egomaniacal quest for wealth.
Yes.
And build a moat around your life.
Yeah.
Or an existential despair, and you start rereading the Beat Poets and put on your black turtleneck sweater.
Sackcloth and ashes.
It's to say, hey, let's do something about it is really a radical choice when you think about it compared to the challenge. It's so immense.
You made the same radical choice in 62,
right,
coming together in Port Huron. I have a question. As you were together, how many of you were there drafting that statement when you went to that retreat in Port
Huron? I'm going to speak on this subject tonight because I am an archaeological dig. I am a primary source, and I can tell you I don't know.
Okay.
Because there was some coming and going, but it was in the range of 60.
All right. Was there a sense of agreement? Was there dissension? We hear, for example, when the Founding Fathers were drafting the Constitution, there was a lot of dissension. So what was the mood?
Similar to the Founding Fathers and Mothers, I suppose. there was the specter of the empire out there. We knew we were in trouble. What I would say is that it started off on in a spirit of being completely overwhelmed with the scale of the project starting on the first night, but we found a participatory way to handle it. We took the 60 pages or 25,000 words and we broke it into sections, you know, like students, values, morality, politics, foreign policy, the economy, the university, and we formed groups of 12 who would take the draft that I wrote, and they would debate it, and it was ambitious stuff. What is human nature? And then they would decide how to revise the draft, and come back in a general assembly, and the workshops would propose their changes, and people would discuss that and make accommodations. And this went on for 5 days. And when we were done, it was quite telling. People felt that they'd gone through like a religious conversion. It was a hugely moving experience to feel that we were giving birth to something. And we were too exhausted to vote on the final version. So we adopted a good technique. It was improvised. We said, we affirm this as a living document for future generations, and Tom should go and finish it, finalize it. So it was never clear.
So you were saying this was a living thing. This was not carved in granite. Living document. If you're just joining us, we are having a discussion with Tom Hayden, who is here back at U of M, back in Ann Arbor, to really commemorate the 50th anniversary of the Port Huron Statement, and talking about the roots of the student activism movement, and SDS was at the head of all of that. I want to ask you, Tom, because you do say you are an archaeological dig, and part of archaeology is learning from the past and applying it to the present and hopefully the future. What are the activists of 2012? What can they learn from the activists of the 60s?
I think if you study this period, it's infinitely deep and fascinating, but you can get lost in it. I mean, all you really need to know is go and read the statement itself. There's a book out that I've edited that has the reflections of 12 of us. It's called Inspiring Participatory Democracy. Secondly, I think that the idea of participatory democracy is transcendent. You see it as a first principle of Occupy Wall Street, September statement of last year. And why is that? Because if the representatives we elect are unable to deliver and we're feeling a moral injury and we have specific grievances, whether it's the right to vote or reform Wall Street, it's a foregone prediction of mine that people will go into the streets or they will try to claim dignity for themselves in some way through direct action, community organizing, joining political campaigns at the grassroots level. That's what participatory democracy is. And it's sad that we thought it wasn't radical enough by the late 60s. Mm. It's very inclusive. You said, how did the statement get written with so many diverse viewpoints? Well, I had to draft it, turn it over to other people. It became organically theirs. And you'll find if you parse it carefully that it includes viewpoints because we were trying to build a coalition that was open-ended that would bring in other groups.
Sure.
So it was not a dogmatic line to tell you these are the steps to take.
It was fluid.
It was fluid. It was organic. And it said basically none of these fine things will happen unless you feel that your dignity requires that you participate and we design a society where everybody's dignity is respected. It's voting is important, but more give and take in the family, neighborhood councils to protect against overdevelopment, students to not just be passive recipients of knowledge from their professors, but to participate in a creative learning process. The idea of participatory democracy is wider than the ballot box and is indispensable. If you think about the things we're proud of in America, they inevitably come from participatory democracy and the insistence of people who were considered controversial in the time, starting with the Bill of Rights, starting with the First Amendment.
Tom Hayden, a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you so much.
The 3-day conference Exploring the Port Here on Statement continues through tomorrow. Tom Hayden will be the keynote speaker at 7:30 tonight. And you can go to the stateside page at michiganradio.org, where we've placed a link to the full schedule of speakers and events. Time now to spotlight a local hero, someone here in our state who's doing something to help make a difference. Today, we meet a 20-year-old man from Grand Rapids who's doing something very special to call attention to the illness that's commonly known as chronic fatigue syndrome. He's battled this illness for several years, but it's not keeping him from walking across Michigan. Kerner Buchta left Detroit August 20th and hopes to finish in Holland in just a couple of weeks. Kerner, thanks for joining us. How's it going for you?
It's going great. Thank you, Cindy.
What you are dealing with is commonly known as chronic fatigue syndrome. Tell us a little of your history with chronic fatigue syndrome.
Sure. It's also called myalgic encephalomyelitis, and a lot of people prefer the term ME because it's a little more medical. But anyway, my personal history with the illness, I started to feel symptoms when I was about 12, and things just sort of got worse until I was in ninth grade, and I had to drop out of school, and it took about 4 years to finally find a diagnosis.
So you really are hoping to do a number of things by this walk across Michigan, probably first and foremost to inspire other people dealing with ME, right? Because people would think, oh, you can't do this.
Yes, I don't want to give across the impression that everyone with this illness could simply do this and could just sort of fight through it and overcome it, because the sad fact is most people with this illness will not be able to do something like this. About 88% of people with ME/CFS do not experience any remission of symptoms. Mm. I hope it is inspirational to people, but I hope it isn't seen as just one man sort of, you know, conquering his illness, because that's not how it works.
What have you gotten personally from taking on a very, very tough task and digging in, and here you are 2 months later, you're still doing it? What are you getting out of this?
Yeah, that's a really hard question to answer. The most important thing that I've gotten out of it is just the importance of attitude in life, and it's hard to explain. I think this could have been a very boring and arduous experience, but I feel like I've sort of developed or been forced to develop an attitude of acceptance and living in acknowledgement of my limitations, but not in submission to them. And that's been the most important, most enriching part of this whole experience.
Koerner, thanks for talking with us, and good luck.
Thank you.
And if you know someone who's making their neighborhood, town, or state a better place, let us know. Write to us at stateside@michiganradio.org. They could be our next local hero. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside's engineered by Bob Scon. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening. Let's talk again on Monday.